Episode 334, The Dystopian Dilemma. Do we want to do dystopian or dystopia? Shoot.
I think dystopian is good.
Okay. Just let it roll.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I am Ed Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono, and we are back. With a good one. I suppose that's a little presumptive.
Well, it's bad on two accounts. First, you're promising something that we're not sure of, and you're that's also true. Disparaging all other episodes. So,
well, I said a good one, not the good one.
As compared to Squirrel Girl Retrospective.
That was a great episode.
I thought that was a good episode, actually. Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah. And just to clarify, I'm not making up my love of squirrels.
Yeah, I know.
People are still doubting this.
I know. I forgot who it was, but
John Wilkerson.
John today on Facebook was saying that he just keeps on waiting for you to admit that this is all a joke. This is not a joke.
This is dead serious.
Okay. Well, we should talk about what today is. Now, we started teasing this a little bit at the end of last week's episode.
Yeah.
And then we just stopped.
Right.
Because you realized, wait, this is just the intro for the actual episode.
Yeah, we just wind up having the whole episode right there in the tease.
So
I'm bad at summarizing things.
So here it is. What are we doing today, Ben?
Well, this is going to be kind of a history mystery. Actually, there's not a lot of mystery. But
weren't we going to do a series of histories mysteries?
No.
Yes, we were. You've said this before to me. Like maybe 2 years ago, we were thinking about doing a series on histories mysteries.
Okay. Well, I like the rhyme.
All right.
So why not?
Maybe this is the first installment.
Yeah. But no, we're going to be talking a little bit about how history influences fiction, in particular, how the history of the 20th century influenced the rise of dystopian and post-apocalyptic fiction. And then we're going to kind of talk about, given that the factors that gave rise to those genres are no longer present in our world, why is it that dystopian and post-apocalyptic fiction are hot stuff today in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think it should make for an interesting conversation.
Yeah, when you first told me about this idea, I was blown away. So I'm excited to hear, and I don't know everything you're going to say. So along with the audience, I'll be able to be captivated and hear what you're about to teach us.
All right. I do want to say first that the inspiration for this episode came from listening to another podcast, Hardcore History, which you just started listening to, Matt.
Well, yeah, I thought, you know what? I want to be a little bit educated on what Ben's going to talk about, so I'm going to go check out this podcast. And then first I realized at work today, well, I'm never going to be able to catch up because he has 5 parts to this, what did they call it?
Blueprint for Armageddon.
Yeah, Blueprint for Armageddon. And so I thought, all right, well, maybe I could at least knock out the first episode. Not so fast.
No.
3 hours long.
Yeah, they're very long.
Not bad. I like long podcasts, but I just I'm only 30 minutes into the first episode, but I do believe I'll check it out and listen to it at work.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And if you heard, oh no, 3 hours long or longer, and you felt like, no, I don't want to add that podcast to my rotation, you should reconsider, because he only releases episodes like every 3 or 4 months.
And he's a really good storyteller. He really reminded me of you, Ben, actually.
Well, that's a very high compliment.
Just in the way that he presented his arguments, and I think you're a really good storyteller when you're podcasting and you know, telling the different ideas you have, and you form
talking
things
about
as
squirrels.
Form things as a narrative. And so yeah, that's exactly what he did. So
yeah. So the 2 episodes, or you know, 1 episode in 1 series that kind of serve the inspiration of part of this are his Blueprint for Armageddon series, which is the one you started listening to, Matt, which is about World War I. And then the other one is an episode called Logical Insanity, in which he explores the morality of dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Now, he doesn't get into the sci-fi stuff in the way that we're going to today, but some of the things he was describing kind of piqued this idea in my mind, and so I wanted to make sure we gave credit where credit is due.
Good. Yeah, and I would definitely, even only 30 minutes in, I would also recommend this podcast. I'm going to keep checking it out.
It's fantastic. Okay, so I think maybe the best place to start with this is one of the arguments I want to make off the bat is that history is a significant factor in the development and writing of fiction, especially good fiction. I mean, if we have the image of authors either present day or historically just kind of sitting down at their desks and thinking, oh, what am I going to write today? And then, it just kind of pops into their heads out of the blue. That's not accurate, especially of the good stuff. I think every author is influenced by a number of factors, whether they be personal, whether they be historic, whether they be other writers, whether they be conscious or unconscious. I mean, we're all influenced by things, and writers are, of course, no exception. But history is a big, big influence on the writing of literature, but also the enduring popularity of literature. And I think for proof of that, I have a few examples here, and you could go on all day with this, but for proof of that, maybe, what would be the most influential piece of fiction throughout human history?
Dystopian fiction?
No, any piece of fiction.
You're asking me what I think is the most influential? Oh, I know what you like the most.
No, not what I like. I think there is a definitive correct answer here. What is the most influential piece of fiction throughout history?
Is it the Odyssey?
I would say the Odyssey or the Iliad.
Okay.
And why? Why has the Iliad endured? Well, because of its narrative of what it means to be in war, what war means for the human condition. And that's the reason why the Iliad has, been referenced by everyone for the past 3,000 years.
So just to be clear, not the Odyssey.
Well, no, but I'd say both of them.
Yeah, the Odyssey or the Iliad, but they went on to say...
Yeah, I mean, I had the Iliad, but certainly the Odyssey, of course. I mean, I'm reading James Joyce's Ulysses, which is based on the Odyssey, Ulysses being the Latin version of Odysseus's name. Mm-hmm. And, so much of that novel is about modernist angst and psychological angst. And so, even there, it's like Odysseus being adrift in his journeys at sea, you see how that resonates with the human condition as well. The reason I chose the Iliad for this discussion, though, is because if we're speaking in a historical context, I think the Odyssey would be more influential if we were coming at this from a psychological angle, whereas the Iliad, if we're talking about historical events, that's it.
Okay.
That's where the conversation really starts and stops for that. A couple more examples, though. Beowulf, especially the version of Beowulf that we have, and no doubt there was earlier versions before whatever we have written down came to us. But if you read Beowulf, you'll notice that there's a tension throughout between pagan mythology and pagan images and Christian mythology and Christian images. For example, we learn very early that Grendel, the monster in Beowulf, is a descendant of Cain, in the Bible. So you have this odd blending of the biblical and the pagan. And if you dig into Beowulf scholarship, one of the things you discover very quickly, and I find this very fascinating, is that as this story is being passed down probably by oral tradition, it's developing itself during the time that Europe is being Christianized, as the church is moving into Europe. And so what you have then historically going on is you have people who are first generation Christians or second generation Christians. And it's not like, being the first Christian in your family if you live in America. No, it's like being the first Christian in your culture. You think about the anxiety that causes on a mental level. What does that mean for your grandparents who, sacrificed to whatever your pagan idol was? What does that mean for your parents, for however far back that was? And so we see that this historical occurrence works itself out in fiction, right? Mm-hmm. And then the example of what we're all reading right now, or some of us, the Divine Comedy. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff in there. Right. Everything from Dante's personal history. Beatrice was a real person, the person that has sent Virgil to him at the beginning. There's his political history of what was going on in Florence at the time. He was exiled from Florence. And as you go through, you'll find all these weird references to the whites and the blacks. And these were these two parties in Florence. And Dante is on the losing side of this, and he gets exiled. And so you have history at that level, and you have a theological history. I mean, the Divine Comedy has been called the Summa in Verse because Dante's so influenced by Thomas Aquinas, which it's easy for us to think, oh, those are both long time ago. Well, they were, but they're actually remarkably close together in history. I mean, the Summa is published about half a century before Dante sits down to write the Divine Comedy. You know, it's like being influenced by J.R.R. Tolkien if you're writing something today. Mm-hmm. It's incredible that they're that close together in human history. So you have all that. So the point here isn't to talk about those necessarily, but to talk about, to make the case that history is a factor, not the only factor, but history is a factor in the development of fiction and its enduring popularity.
I think we agree with that.
All right. That's good. Somebody out there saying, I don't. Well, you're alone. And nobody cares about your dissenting opinion. All right. No, we care. We care. So that brings us to the 20th century. Now, the 20th century history takes a radical shift in many, many, many ways. I mean, even think like 100 years ago, people are walking around and or not walking around, they're riding around in horse-drawn carriages and everything, and everybody's got cars. It's like, it's simply the most explosive century in human history.
Yes.
An explosive in a metaphorical sense and in a literal sense.
As we're about to find out.
Because I think that almost more than anything, almost more than our technology or cars or anything like that, warfare is what makes a change in human history in the 20th century, starting with World War One, which is what you are learning about.
Right.
In the hardcore middle, history.
Yeah. In the middle of Blueprint to Armageddon Part 1.
That's right.
It's interesting.
It is. Yeah. So how familiar were you with World War One before you started all this?
I'll be really honest. Not very familiar.
Yeah. I mean, it's not...
Everybody just looks at World War II
exactly.
as the big war, and World War One gets overlooked, I think.
It does. It's the less, exciting war. I think it's a war where... part of it is, I think, that there isn't as clear a villain mm-hmm. in World War One. You don't have a Hitler mm-hmm. running around in World War One. Its origins aren't, the Nazis come to power and decide to try and conquer Europe. Its origins are, as we were talking about before we started recording, this Archduke gets assassinated, and it's almost like dominoes. One thing leads to another, and then, this country goes to war with that one, but the country they attacked had a treaty with, this country. Mm-hmm. And so all these treaties trigger each other, and it becomes a nightmare of how this war that started with pretty small event. I mean, not that any assassination is small, but, in the grand scheme of things, it's one guy gets shot. And within a relatively short period of time, all these dominoes fall over and the entire world is at war with one another.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It is. And World War One is significant because, you think about that it directly leads to World War II. It directly leads to the rise of Nazi Germany. Obviously, I'm not at the end of Blueprint for Armageddon yet either, but World War One concludes with the Germans losing. Well, spoiler alert.
Spoilers there.
History spoilers. And the Germans get hit with the Treaty of Versailles.
Oh, yeah.
Are you familiar with the Treaty of Versailles?
Am I ever? Huh. I was at, in a trip to France, I went to Versailles.
Yeah. Did you see the treaty?
I don't think the treaty was on display.
I don't know if it is either.
I have some pictures of the buildings, though.
Yeah. So Germany takes the blame in the Treaty of Versailles for the war, partly because they lost. You tend to, if you lose a war, you don't necessarily have the best negotiating terms, partly because they had a lot of responsibility for what happened. But the Treaty of Versailles, everyone acknowledges from a historical standpoint that it is atrocious. It is a nightmare for the German people, and not in a good way. Not in a, hey, you kind of caused this war, you're going to help us clean it up type of way. No, it is draconian in what it imposes on the German people, and specifically economically. German workers, inflation got so out of control in Germany because of what happened at the Treaty of Versailles, where the German government winds up just printing money to take care of their debts. And inflation gets so out of control where German workers are paid three times a day because the money that you are paid in the morning is worthless by the time you get off work at 5.
I did not know that.
It's incredible. It is incredible. And why does Hitler come to power? It's because you do that to a country, you put a country into that type of environment, and that's how you produce crazies. You know, that's when somebody like a Hitler who comes along and starts talking about the glory of Germany, you know, starts to sound like he's got it all together. Now, remember, for the German people who elect Hitler, none of them know about the Holocaust. That hasn't happened yet. He isn't the monster. He's a guy who comes along and starts saying, hey, we got a really raw deal here, and the German people deserve better. And when you're getting paid three times a day because the money you got paid in the morning is worthless by the time you get off work at night, and somebody comes along and says, you got a raw deal, and you're looking at your life and saying, yeah, I've got a raw deal, he starts to sound really good. And that's why Hitler gets elected. He gets elected, remember. Hitler doesn't take over Germany. He gets elected democratically. And the Nazis come to power in Germany, and that starts World War II, which in turn sets off the Cold War, and on and on and on it goes. So, you know, World War I is really the linchpin. But World War I is also unique because it not only does it, you know, serve as kind of this first domino that knocks over all the others for these horrible things in the 20th century, you know, everything from, you know, and under the umbrella of the Cold War, we need to not only think of, you know, James Bond being a spy running around, but, you know, you're talking about things like Vietnam, you're talking about things like Korea, things like the Cuban Missile Crisis. All those are part of the Cold War. You know, the Berlin Wall, all this stuff falls under the umbrella of the Cold War. The fact that Saddam Hussein came to power in Iraq as part of the Cold War, the fact that, you know, the Taliban developed as part of the Cold War, we're still picking up the pieces from that today. And that's not to say that having those people come to power is right, wrong, or indifferent. I mean, that's a very complicated question. It's just to say that we're still dealing with the dominoes falling over from World War I today.
And not to be a conspiracy theorist, but a lot of people think the Cold War never ended. It just publicly ended.
Yeah.
Thought.
Russia was putting us on.
Oh! We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that in a future episode.
Yeah. I mean, certainly it ended in the sense that, you know, we're not living in the 70s where we all have nukes aimed right at each other.
Right.
We'll get to that later. But warfare in World War I changes drastically from a number of perspectives. Now, I'm going to kind of lump these together with World War II. But the death tolls absolutely skyrocket. One of the quotes Dan Carlin comes back to in Hardcore History when he's talking about this World War I series is he said, talks about how Napoleon brags that he loses 30,000 men a month. You know, that's Napoleon's big brag, that his army is so all over the place and so crazy, they're losing 30,000 men a month. World War I, you're losing 30,000 men a day in battles. It is insane. And so you have death tolls skyrocketing, but you also have things like trench warfare. You have chemical warfare. Another point that I taken from Dan Carlin is that he talks about how in war up to this point, you know, you have two armies that are kind of running around and they come together, they clash, they have a battle, and then they go their separate ways. When you hit World War I, you have two armies that clash and they don't separate. Why? Because you have things like tanks, you have mortar shells, you have bombs, you have chemical weapons, you have airplanes, you have all this stuff that is going on that prevents the armies from separating. And so you just have these, you know, instead of we're going to clash for a day and the battle lasts for a day, we start fighting in the morning and we're done with the fight by supper time. It's going on for weeks. It's going on for months. And the, you know, fronts extending incredibly long distances and all of this stuff. And so warfare drastically is changing. And part of this you have to understand then is the sheer amount of death that is occurring. So if you're one of these countries involved in this war, you know, these wars, World War I or World War II, and you're a male of the age where, because of course women aren't fighting in armies at this point, where you are either going to be drafted or called up or you're in a reserves or something, you know, the odds of you dying are incredibly high. If you are a civilian anywhere in Europe, anywhere, your odds of dying during this time are incredibly high. you know, when it comes to bombings, we always think of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, rightly so. You know, having two atomic bombs dropped on cities is a big deal. But we also need to remember things like the fire bombings that went on, the London Blitz. Mm-hmm. You know, think about that for a second. That over a period of, like, what, 8 months or something? If you're living in London, those air raid sirens can go off at any second, and German airplanes are going to fly over your city and drop bombs on you. Like, think of living in those conditions. You almost can't imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
I have some numbers here for how many people died in bombings over World War II. 60,000 British civilians. Of course, these are all estimates. 160,000 airmen. 67,000 French civilians. 600,000 German civilians. Because fire bombings that took place there in Japan, between 330 and 500,000 civilians, you know, and the casualties from Hiroshima and Nagasaki are really only a fraction of that. Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about only 130,000 people died in those bombings, only, and then the 500,000. And of course, we didn't drop any nukes on Germany, and there you have between 300,000 and 600,000 people dying. You can't even fathom those numbers, you know, and that's not even getting into things like, the things like the Holocaust and all of that, because that's the other part, of course, is that it's one thing to say I might die in a war. It's one thing to say I might die because of a war. But then the other horror that's going on and looming over your head, especially if you're living in Europe during World War One or World War Two, is that I could be living under a dictatorial regime within a matter of days. You know, that's what the goal of the London Blitz was to conquer the British Islands. You know, that was the goal, was to take over that country. And we all talk, you know, the Holocaust is obviously the one people know best, and that's nothing to sneeze at. But the numbers there, it gets even more horrifying from there. So the Holocaust, 6 million Jews die.
It's horrible.
Which is 67% of the population of Jews in Europe at that time. Of people, you know, who are just regular Germans, 1 out of 11 Germans dies as part of the Nazi regime. If you just think about that. But the big winner is Stalin. Estimates go up to 50 million people died under Stalin's regime.
Wow.
You know, and so you have all of this going on. And then, so that's kind of in Europe. But then it extends to America during the Cold War. You know, we have the phrase mutually assured destruction is the only reason that things stay cold, if you will. Mm-hmm. And really, they don't. I mean, things like Vietnam and Korea are hot parts of the Cold War, mm-hmm. of course. But think about that. The only reason we're not at war right now is because if we go to war, everyone launches their nukes and we all die. Like, that's the reality that U.S. citizens, everyone in the world is living under from the end of World War II to, you know, the fall of the communist regime in Russia. I came across a summary of a report.
Isn't that still the case, sort of, today? I mean,
not nearly to the same degree.
We don't have them aimed at anybody, but we could quickly aim them wherever we wanted.
Yeah.
So in a sense, we're not pointing the gun at anybody right now, but in a sense, the whole world is still living under that shadow.
That's true. I think the difference is nobody has their finger on the trigger.
Right. Okay.
You know, think about the Cuban Missile Crisis. All of a sudden, 90 miles off the coast of Florida, you have potential nuclear weapons being moved into that. Or I don't know if they were nuclear or not, but you have weapons that could obliterate the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an enemy regime that's ready to use them. And that's what's going on, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 60s. And so you're right. We still have that threat, but it's nowhere near as real.
Okay.
You know, your neighbor's not out digging a bomb shelter.
Right.
Or if he is, he's going to show up on Doomsday Preppers or some other reality show. Whereas if you're living in the 60s and your neighbor's out digging a bomb shelter, you're not thinking, what a nut job. You're thinking, maybe I should grab the shovel too.
So, and this is the same time period where elementary school kids were taught to duck under their desks in case of an emergency, in case of an emergency bombing.
Exactly. Now, I think that it's kind of this weird hypothetical thing where we think about, well, what would have happened if all-out nuclear war breaks out? Well, of course, this is something that was of grave concern in the middle of the Cold War. What would happen? Well, there was a report from the U.S. Congress's Office of Technology called The Effects of War. And I found a summary of this on, where did I find it? HistoryNewsNetwork.org today. And, you know, in this report, The Effects of War, kind of dealt with a number of different scenarios. But the one that I think is the most interesting, or at least the most horrific, is what if everybody just launches their bombs? What happens? Well, this report estimated that 70 to 160 million people in the U.S. would die instantly as a result of that. Now, that's, remember, the population isn't as high back then. So you're talking 80% of the population of the United States dies instantly if this happens. But the fun doesn't stop there, of course, because then you have to deal with radiation. And then because of radiation, you have to deal with a food shortage, not only for the U.S., but for the entire world, because the U.S. is supplying a huge percentage of food for the world. And so, you know, if the finger that's on the trigger squeezes and that happens, you're talking the end of civilization as you know it, or what some might call a post-apocalyptic scenario.
And there it is.
And there it is.
That brings us to today's conversation.
That brings us to today's conversation, right. You know, to circle, so to kind of begin tying the two things we've talked about so far, it's okay, history influences fiction. Well, it shouldn't surprise us at all that history influenced this fiction on a number of levels. You know, maybe the most obvious Cold War one is James Bond, right? Why did James Bond become a cultural icon? Well, I mean, certainly it's not a serious treatment of Cold War politics, but what it is it becomes a form of wish fulfillment, you know, it becomes a form of we can beat these guys because we have, you know, power of James Bond on our
super
side.
Spies.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so it becomes a way of working out some of that psychological angst in a less serious way, which I think you need. You need those release valves if, you know, you're waiting for the missiles to start dropping out of the sky any day now. You know, and then you get stuff like Doctor Strangelove and all of that. Before I get to the post-apocalyptic one, I briefly wanted to touch on J.R.R. Tolkien, the influence on him, because this is very interesting. Were you aware, Matt, that Tolkien served in the British Army during World War One?
I was actually aware.
Yeah, and it was highly influential on his fiction, especially on his depiction of Mordor. You know, one of the things he writes in, I believe this is in his introduction to Lord of the Rings, he says, "One has indeed personally to come under the shadow of war to feel fully its oppression, but as the years go by, it seems now often forgotten that to be caught in youth by 1914, which was the year World War One started, was no less hideous an experience than to be involved in 1939 and the following years. By 1918, when World War One ended, all but one of my close friends were dead."
Wow. Man, that would be horrible.
Yeah. You know, you think about that. And so what you have going on in Tolkien's depiction of Mordor is you have a World War One battlefield kind of filtered through a Thomistic Catholic understanding of evil as Thomas's. And what I mean by that is St. Thomas's understanding of evil is that evil is literally nothing. Evil is uncreation. Evil is, you know, the way I've explained it to people, and I think this is kind of a helpful analogy, is you think about like the game Jenga, where you poke out the blocks, right? And you hope the tower doesn't fall over. Evil is the poking out of the blocks in Jenga. It's literally creating holes of nothingness in creation, which is a very terrifying way of thinking about it. And you see this reflected in his fiction. In Lord of the Rings, when Sam and Frodo go into Shelob's lair, the way that he describes it, and the movie does a good job like depicting this as a horrible situation, but you don't get the full effect because the way that he describes is when they go into Shelob's lair, they're overcome by this darkness that not only isn't an absence of light, but it's an absence of anything, you know? And so Tolkien is filtering. He sees in World War One something that connects to this Thomistic idea of evil as literally nothing. And then he writes that into his fiction. The OneRing.net, which is a Tolkien fan site, found a really interesting comparison where there's two brief paragraphs here I want to read. The first one is from a French soldier describing a battlefield. And the second one is a passage from Lord of the Rings that's almost identical in terms of the content that it has to say. And it's very fascinating to see how this works out. So, and whether or not Tolkien actually read this or just had very similar experiences is, you know, I don't know. But if he didn't read this, it certainly would have resonated with him if he did. So this is the French soldier. He says, "The stars shine brilliantly, and these trenches facing north, I gaze at the plow," meaning the Big Dipper, "dipping towards high wood. What joy it is to know that you in England," or maybe it's an English soldier, I don't know, "and I out here," I think it was an English soldier in France, so there you go, "that you in England and I out here at least can look upon the same beauty in the sky, to have become seers, images of divine stability, guardians of peace and order beyond the power of weak and petty madness. They," meaning the stars, "at least will outlast the war and still be beautiful." And then you have this passage from Return of the King of Sam walking through Mordor. And he says, "Far above the Ethel Duath," which is a geographical part of Mordor, "in the west, the night sky was still dim and pale. There, peeping among the cloud rack above a dark tor high in the mountains, Sam saw a white star twinkle for a while. The beauty of it smote his heart as he looked up out of the forsaken land, and courage returned to him. For like a shaft, clear and cold, the thought pierced him that in the end, the shadow was only a small and passing thing. There was light and high beauty forever beyond its reach." And so you start to see how, in probably the great fiction work of the 20th century, part of its greatness, it's not an allegory for war, as some people have said that Tolkien intended, but it is this working out of the horror of what it's like to be in that type of situation. Mm-hmm. And so this type of thing is going on. So you have all that. You have this history of war that has all of a sudden gone from being, you know, war is always hell, but now war is hell. You know, it's amplified big time in the 20th century. And then you have the Cold War, and you have all this stuff. And along then comes the development of this dystopian and post-apocalyptic fiction. And I think at this point in the conversation, it ought to be blindingly obvious why this happens. Mm-hmm. You know, why did these genres suddenly explode? It's not like you never had the concept of a dystopia before in fiction, but all of a sudden in the 20th century, they explode. Why? Well, it's because you could wake up tomorrow and see Russian bombs dropping on your house. And if you survive, you will be living in a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Yeah, to them, it was almost like they were looking at the world around them and guessing what could be the actual realistic mm-hmm. future.
Yep. If you're British and you're living in London during the Blitz, the RAF fails one night, the Germans obliterate everything, and all of a sudden you are living in a dystopia, especially if you're Jewish and living in Britain at that time. You know, you're going to die in that dystopia. And so the need to work this out is very important to the human condition. It works itself out in literature. I have a few examples here. A book called A Canticle for Leibowitz is one of the most popular post-apocalyptic novels written during this time. Are you familiar with The Canticle for Leibowitz?
I am, but mostly because I think you mentioned it once right before we did our top 100 authors countdown.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I got brought up during the countdown.
So, A Canticle for Leibowitz takes place at a Catholic monastery in a post-apocalyptic world. And as the novel goes on, the author, Walter M. Miller, is developing this concept of how the church can act as an ark in this post-apocalyptic world. And the post-apocalyptic world of the novel becomes an equivalent of the Dark Ages in the Middle Ages, and the way that the church acted as a haven for beauty and intellect and culture in that area, the same way it can act now. And so it becomes a work of comfort, you know, at that point, that, hey, if the bombs fall, it doesn't mean everything has to be gone, especially if you're reading it as a religious person, though its popularity extends to people of all beliefs. It's not just a Christian book or even explicitly a Christian book, but it's, hey, if you know, that somehow this stuff will survive. This won't be the end of human culture if it happens. And then on the other hand, you have a book like 1984 that comes out right in here as you're busy working your way through. Are you enjoying 1984 anymore?
Okay, so get this.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, but it's split into parts. So yeah. Part one, part two, and I'm guessing there's a part three. Have you read it?
Oh, yeah.
How many parts are there?
I don't remember how many parts. But,
yeah. Okay, so, and then there's chapters inside each of those parts. Well, the first part, I was starting to get a little drawn out. I was getting a little bit bored. But by the time you get to part two, which I just got to in the last few weeks here, it's sort of taken off a little bit for me. So yeah. I'll be honest, I was bored at first,
yeah,
and now I'm actually enjoying my time reading it. I see firmly I have a problem of too many books on my plate at once. Because if I would just focus on one, I could get some done. But it's going to be funny, at some point mid-year, I'm going to just have
a slew of 20 books that you finish in a week.
I mean, for real. So yeah, this is one that I guarantee I will not exit 2015 without finishing this book.
All right. That's good. So yeah. I won't give away the ending or anything. But I think you can already see that it is a very pessimistic look at what this would be like. It's not only a dystopia, but it's a world of dystopias that Orwell is painting.
So with Big Brother, the villain, but which represents a government that's gone bad, who do you think Orwell saw that government as?
Oh, I mean, certainly it's a reflection of the USSR. Okay. I think, though, it's probably a compilation of numerous dystopian regimes.
So is the picture of Big Brother that they show, is that Stalin?
Probably. I know the covers. There's several covers that kind of make him look like Stalin in the book. I don't know if that's something Orwell necessarily intended. But, I mean, you have Stalin as obviously the big one. But he's writing this in the 1940s, too.
Yeah, I think I think it was completed in 1947 and published in 1948, which is where we get the year flipped, 1984. Yeah,
exactly. So you have that, but then, you know, you also have to think that you had the fascists in Spain, and you had Benito Mussolini in Italy, and you had Hitler in Germany. So you've got plenty of influences to draw from, you know, 10 years ago. Yeah, think of what was going on 10 years ago here, you know, in our lives. It's like, that's really recent. Mm-hmm. I mean, not even 10 years ago. World War II ends in 1945. You know, it's like, this is yesterday, practically. We've been doing the sci-fi Christian longer than there was time between the end of World War II and when Orwell's writing this. So in that, you know, books like I Am Legend, which really shows the anxiety of what it means to become the enemy. And you're working out stuff like that. I mean, you can play that game all day. A lot of Philip K. Dick stuff. Comic books, I think, have, in various ways, kind of played a similar James Bond-type role of helping us to work out some of the anxiety of what's ever going on at the time in a safer setting. Also, in World War II, of course, they propagandistic role they played, which I don't necessarily use in a negative sense, you know, but the infamous image of Captain America punching out Adolf Hitler, you know, that's so you see how fiction's being driven by all of this. So it's no surprise, given what we just described, that post-apocalyptic dystopian fiction is huge during this time. And then we come to today. And this is where things are confusing to me, okay?
Let me say, you've gone on record as stating that you're sick of and think that they're of low quality, the current crop of dystopian fiction, specifically young adult books.
Right. I would agree with that. But let's put their quality aside. I want to think mainly about their popularity. But before we get there, I just want to highlight a few changes today. Because not only are we not living with our finger on the trigger, but it's almost in a very short period of time. We're talking 25 years since the fall of the USSR. You know, give or take. I think it was 89, 90, somewhere in there. I don't know the exact date. But the world is vastly different. And yes, there are violent regimes out there. And I want to make I want to offer a very, very careful disclaimer here at the beginning of this section. When I start to compare today's world to the world of the 20th century, I do not for one second want to sound like I am minimizing any deaths that take place in today's world. I don't want to sound like I'm minimizing that from the perspective of 9/11 or the Iraq War or, you know, the people living under regimes like North Korea or anything like that. Okay?
Right.
Every death is a tragedy. But at the same time, psychologically, we live in a very different world. You know, consider that the biggest thing North Korea has done, and they might not have even been responsible for it, depending on whose side of the story you listen to, is get the interview with Seth Rogen released on Netflix instead of in theaters. That's their big attack against us. That's a far cry from having your finger on enough nuclear weapons to wipe out 80% of the U.S. population.
And in case people are listening to this in the future,
yeah,
the current... that current pop culture reference is North Korea or somebody, we don't know who for sure, hacked into Sony Movie Studios' email system and released publicly a bunch of personal and business emails. Then they threatened that they would attack movie theaters that showed the interview.
Yeah.
And so interview was never... I think it was really minimally
very, very few
released.
A few independent chains.
But it was immediately put on video on demand online. And then a few weeks later, it was available for free on Netflix. Or free to paying subscribers of Netflix.
Yeah.
So that's current culture.
You know, so it's good job, North Korea. You really got us. Now, I mean, I don't want to minimize that either. Because it makes me mad that people, you know, that anybody tries to infringe on our freedoms. And even that way, that should anger you as an American citizen, but it's like angry annoying instead of, oh dear, the world might end tomorrow. You know, a perfect example of how things have changed is you're familiar with the movie Red Dawn.
I am familiar. I know that there was an older one in the 80s.
I think the early 80s,
and they just had one with Chris Hemsworth. And I didn't see either, though.
I have seen the first one a while back. I didn't see the remake.
And the first one, the Russians are the villains, right?
Yes.
And China is the villain for the new one. Remake. Okay.
Yeah. Now, I've seen the first one. I haven't seen the second one. The premise of both is that the Russians in the first one, the Chinese in the new one, invade America, essentially take over, and a bunch of kids go to the mountains and, you know, fight back. You know, so they're not good movies. The first one is not a good movie, and I only can assume based on the horrifying reviews that I would have the same opinion of the second one.
Yeah, it got a 12 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Exactly. But the first one is still a bad movie, but it is a cultural icon. Why? Because the Russians landing on our shores was a legitimate threat. China's not going to invade. It's absurd. It's a joke. You know, it's just, for as bad as the Chinese regime is in many ways, and it is bad, it's not an equivalent. It's not even close for the average American citizen of being an equivalent of what the USSR was during the Cold War. Not even close. For one, we owe them way too much money for them to attack us. So there's that. You know, maybe that's the secret strategy, but we won't go there. You know, warfare is vastly different today. We talked about how, you know, if you're a male of military age living in Europe during World War One or World War Two, or even America after those, the wars, we get involved in those wars, your chances of dying are very, very good. Well, you know, again, I don't want to minimize any of the deaths, but we had, let's see if I have the number written down here somewhere, but, you know, something like 4,500 American deaths in Iraq compared to 400,000 in World War Two. So even if you wind up in the army today, your chances of surviving are vastly different. Whereas, I mean, you watch the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. It's like, you've seen Saving Private Ryan, man. No,
I haven't.
Oh, my goodness.
No,
I haven't. Oh, that's horrifying.
Sorry.
you know, but the first 30 minutes, which I'll tell you because I assume everybody else listening is familiar with them, is that it depicts the D-Day invasion. Mm-hmm. So you have these kind of boats that come in, and the ramp drops on the boat, and then the soldiers invade on the beach. And so, of course, the Germans know they're coming, and they've got, you know, the gun position set up. So, and what the movie depicts, and this, of course, really happened, is that the ramp drops on the boat for the soldiers to run out, and instantly half of them are dead. You know, and that's really happened. It's like, and so you're sitting there in that boat, you're waiting for, you know, that the second your boat hits the shore, you've got a 50-50 shot of dying instantly. You know, that's horrifying. And it's just not the same today. That doesn't mean that our soldiers are any less courageous or worthy of thanks or anything like that. I don't want to come across like that for one second, but it's not the same. It's not the same. Same thing with 9/11. Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. It's not the same as what happened in the bombings. It's not the same as what happened in the Holocaust. Have you ever been to a Holocaust museum, Matt?
Yeah, I was. Again, on that trip to Europe, I went to a Holocaust museum.
Yeah, and I was at one in Jerusalem, Yad Vashem. And it almost doesn't feel real, you know, when you go there. It doesn't feel like it happened. Now, I want to be very clear. I'm not denying the Holocaust. It did happen. I would tell you that psychologically, when you're there, you're walking through and you're looking at this, you know, my reaction to all of that, or my reaction when I watch something like Schindler's List, or even when I hear the history, is, how did this happen? You know, this doesn't feel real. We feel so far removed today from it. And really, it's a couple generations ago.
I know you had sent over in your notes, when you compare numbers, you said earlier the millions that were lost in the Holocaust, and compared to 9/11, how many did you say there were?
For 9/11? Yeah. About 3,000 people died that day. Okay. Horrible. Tragic. But it's not, you know, you compare that to the London Blitz, where 40,000 people died over those months. In Hiroshima, 60 to 80,000 people die instantly. You know, and so the point isn't these deaths are more important than those deaths. That's not what I'm saying. It's that psychologically, we don't live in the same world.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're giving these caveats, because you're just setting the stage for comparing history and our reaction when it comes to literature in these different eras.
Exactly.
You're not treating the deaths differently. So I'm glad you're saying that.
Yeah, because you know somebody's going to email you. If, why you hate 9/11? You know?
I mean, yeah, if there's anybody that has family members that are overseas right now fighting for America or has lost somebody, so I'm glad that you're...
Right. It's very important. But it's just psychologically, the average American, and that's a good point about families, because individual people might suffer more in today's world than back then. That's entirely possible. There's people who were living in Britain who had nice, cozy lives during the entire thing, and there's people living in America today with horrible lives. But by and large, your odds as an American citizen in today's world are much better of living than they would be if you were a European citizen throughout the 20th century. So given that, given the fact then that I would say because of those differences, we do not live in a world that lends itself to post-apocalyptic or dystopian fiction.
Yeah, it's interesting.
This happen then?
When you first brought this up, I didn't know exactly where you were going to go with it, and then you flesh it out by sending me some of your notes, and it is interesting psychologically. It feels like there was that era that you talked about before where it was very popular, and it feels like this is the second wave era of popularity for that genre.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, so I'm excited to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, you know... And the objection I think I could hear some people raise is, well, we still have threats today. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, there's still a lot of nuclear weapons. Yeah, there is, but it's not the same. Some people might bring up environmental stuff like global warming. It's like, you know, even if the most alarming global warming estimates are accurate, you're not going to wake up tomorrow morning and have Miami be underwater. You know, it's like we're talking a slow thing over many, many years. And there's a lot of people who don't believe it at all. But the point isn't that that is or isn't a threat. It's that even if it is a threat, psychologically, it's a threat that doesn't have the same effect as you might have bombs dropping on your house when you wake up tomorrow morning. That's different.
Yeah. So as you were thinking through this, preparing for the episode, what did you come up with? Why it's popular today?
Well, you could. I think there's some where, as history, you know, I think the history and fiction cycle kind of goes through a few different phases. I think that on one hand, you have fiction being driven by what is happening now in history. But then you also have a processing stage of history, you know, and two movies I've already mentioned, Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, of course, those aren't threats when Steven Spielberg makes those movies. But they serve a popular or an important role in kind of the processing of those events, especially for somebody like Steven Spielberg, who's Jewish by descent, to realize that, hey, you know, had I lived in Europe 50 years ago, that could have been me. Mm-hmm. You know, for all of us as Americans watching something like Saving Private Ryan, to realize, hey, you probably have grandparents or, you know, very nearly related relatives who were there or could have been there or were close to there or something like that. You know, my paternal grandfather he was from Italy originally. He and his family fled Italy when the fascists came to power and moved to Egypt. He worked for the RAF as an engineer during World War II. So he wasn't involved in combat, but, you know, we're all young enough or old enough, I should say, where we have relatives who were there, who saw it, who witnessed mm-hmm. it. And so, So fiction also can serve a role as kind of the debriefing, if you will, the cultural debriefing in the centuries or decades after major events. And I imagine we'll be debriefing from things like the Holocaust and World War II for a long time to come. We're still debriefing from Vietnam, not to the same extent as we were in the 80s or 70s when you have movies like Apocalypse Now or Full Metal Jacket coming out or stuff like that. But it still is an issue today. So you could have that, but yet that's not really a satisfactory answer to me because, and granted, because I'm not a fan of it, really. I haven't read tons and tons of the post-apocalyptic genre or dystopian stuff, but it doesn't seem like Katniss is there to help us work out what would have happened if Stalin had moved in.
No, I'm curious. I don't get the sense that you're against post-apocalyptic fiction as a whole, but you seem to have something against young adult fiction.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, I think that maybe that's where, because I'll be very honest and a very anticlimactic here, I don't have a perfect answer for this. I have some ideas.
Yeah.
But it's more one where I'm curious what other people think, of course.
I think an even more interesting question is, if our generation, and I'm saying we're not the general audience, I don't believe, for young adult fiction. Maybe we are in some ways, according to the publishers. Yeah. But we shouldn't be. It should be teenagers or, you know, early 20s. If you and I, you're in the 30s area, I'm 30, almost 33, and you're going to be 30 this year. Yep. If it doesn't resonate with us, why would it resonate with this? I don't know what. Not generation. Well, maybe generation. Yeah, the generation.
People born in the 90s. Yeah, yeah. You know, because you and I both lived part of our lives during the Cold War, but I mean, I don't remember any of that. You might have some memory. I don't know if news reports of the Berlin Wall.
Remember the Berlin Wall one. I think it was.
You were like, what, 6, 7, something like that?
Yeah, you were saying the years earlier. I think that was 91. I didn't do a check. Okay. I could check it, but it's around the early 90s.
So you're 7, 8. I'm 6, 7, somewhere in there. We're so young that that wasn't part of our lives, even if we lived through the very tail end of it.
Oh, man, you were totally right the first time. 1989.
Okay.
November 9th, 1989.
So you were born in 82. So mm-hmm. you're 7, I'm 4. You know, you have memories of that, of hearing about it or news reports or something. I don't have any memories. But yeah, I it's kind of like what 9/11 would be like to kids born in the mid 90s or late 90s or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's just, you don't remember it the same way. Whereas 9/11 for me, where I'm 15, 16 somewhere. Yeah. I'm almost 16 when 9/11 hits. I mean, I remember everything about that day, and I'm sure you do too. It's like, it's a very different experience. So yeah, I think so given the fact of what you're saying, then it's absolutely right. Is that it's even for us, that world feels far away.
It's even more remote for the kids younger than us.
Exactly. Exactly.
So why, Ben? What, I know you said you don't have a definitive answer, but what are some things that you're throwing out there as
possibilities? Well, let me throw out two. And I'll start with this one. I think that the fact that we live in a very unique pocket of history, and it probably is only a pocket. I mean, I imagine that given the fact that history repeats itself, things will heat up again at some point. But at least in our culture, and there are parts of the world where things are very violent and scary.
So you're talking about from an American perspective.
Exactly. For most of, if not all of the people listening to us right now.
What? We have tons of international listeners.
Yeah, like UK.
Oh, you never know.
You never know. Okay, but most of our listeners, at least, we live in a world that's very unique in human history in terms of our relative safety. We live in a world that we're not going to go to war. Even if we do go to war, we're probably going to survive it. You know, our country is going to win. There's no barbarians at the gate, you know, for if you're living in ancient Rome, which would be just about the most comparable historical situation you could imagine as some of those great empires. But even there, it's like, you know, if you go into the Roman army, your odds of death are a lot higher than they are if you go into the American army today. And so we live in this pocket of history that's pretty calm. And given that history is such a huge factor in driving fiction, I think we don't have anything driving us today. And I think that it impacts our fiction, and not for the best. You know, I think there's a reason why, you know, who's going to be the next Tolkien? There isn't going to be one, because it's not the same. And that doesn't mean there can't be great writers in today's world.
You're saying because something so psychologically impactful,
right,
as war,
yeah,
is the catalyst for great
stuff
literature?
Like that. Absolutely. Or at least it's a catalyst and an important one. And we don't have that today. And so you start looking to other areas. And this ties to things we've talked about before. And this gets to what would be, you know, kind of the second and related reason.
I kind of want to ask a question.
Yeah.
Should I not derail you right now?
No, go for it.
So are you saying, just to clarify, that because it's a period of calm, that authors now are creating this chaos or, you know, dystopian, post-apocalyptic, to entertain us, and because we're so far away from it, so it's not a debriefing like you said before, but yeah, it's went into entertainment because we're so removed from something like that not joke around, but we can dabble in it because we're not afraid of it.
Exactly right. It becomes about hype, it becomes about marketing, it becomes about amusement, it becomes about things like wish fulfillment. Not wish fulfillment in the way that I mentioned with like comic books and James Bond during the 20th century, where you could say, okay, that's a wish fulfillment, but it's a wish fulfillment that also serves as kind of the pressure release valve on the psyches of the readers and viewers. And you could say that has a very important thing, that when you're in that kind of hotbed, you need that. You need that pressure release valve.
You know, a theme of those tends to be individualism, where there's some hero who's set apart. It's usually a female. She's different in some way, and she's got to stop or, you know, revolt against this powerful regime.
Yeah.
Maybe what those stories are expressing is more individualism rather than working something out internally.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, there's something in us that seeks meaning, seeks relevance in a world that's relatively quiet. And I think there are ways to find meaning and relevance, of course, you know, but that we stop dealing with the times that we are living in. When the times we are living in become inconsequential, it throws us into a different type of mental angst. And I think you're right, that's part of what's being worked out there, is a wish fulfillment in the sense of write the character that's easy for target audience to identify with and then go to town. And unfortunately, it doesn't make for great literature, because great literature isn't about individual wish fulfillment. Great literature is about what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that's what literature is about. And what it means to be human in your times, given the traumatic events of life. And when you have fiction being written by people who are without trauma in the world around them or in their personal lives, and being written for people without any special trauma, not to say, we all have trauma, of course, but I'm talking about, like, you know, nobody's going through the Holocaust today. So you have both the production side and the consumption side are lacking the depth to produce greatness, you know, and so it becomes about amusement. I think that people who maybe are shallow people in today's world, and I'm not trying to stereotype all people who like this stuff or anything. I'm just saying that people who are shallow or in today's world, if you are a relatively shallow person and you live in the greatest generation, to steal the Tom Brokaw term of the World War II generation, the world you live in lends you depth. You become a deep person because you have to survive, or simply because you are a product of your times. And when you don't live in a world that lends you that depth, and you're not somebody who is naturally a deep or profound person, and you don't seek it out, but you still have the psychological love of stories that's built into humans, I think you wind up in a place where it becomes all about the hype and the amusement and the entertainment. And it's dangerous for reasons we've talked about before. But then in this context, I think you also have to tack on that it risks becoming exploitive of things that were very, very real not that long ago.
You know, along these same lines, I've said this in the past, so longtime listeners will know this, but I actually do like young adult fiction, so I'm not saying anything bad against that genre or subgenre. I am wondering, though, why these post-apocalyptic stories tend to see them in young adult fiction. I mean, I'm sure in regular fiction they're out there as well, but it feels like the popularity is really revolving around the young adult genre. So any thoughts on that?
I mean, you could go deep into the psychology of it, and I you know, I'm not a psychologist, but if I can put on my Dr. Freud hat for a second, and probably be full of crap as I do so, but I'll give it my best shot. I think you could get into that if these books are written for a teenage audience, people who are coming into the sense of I've got to change the world, you know, that kind of teenage emotion that we all experience to one degree or another. It's a genre that lends itself to that very easily. And when you don't have a world to change by going off to fight Hitler, you look for it in other ways.
I think this is good. I think that's a good analysis.
I think, to go off of fiction for a second, I think it's the same reason why you have people out there who are convinced that Barack Obama is a communist who's about to take over America and sell us to his communist friends, and why there's people who are convinced that George W. Bush was a horrible Nazi who was going to imprison everyone who disagreed with him into internment camps. It's that we don't have Hitler or Stalin the same way that there's still horrible people out there today running horrible.
So people want somebody to hate.
Yeah,
you want a villain.
I think that we naturally are looking for that villain in our history.
That's interesting, because even in stories, like, books, movies, comics, the great stories are the ones that have a great villain.
Right.
You could have a great hero, but if he's facing up against a lame villain, you don't care about that story.
Yeah.
You need sort of the two polar equal but opposites.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that even though our pocket of history is unique, you can look to other times and see what people did when they were living in relative security, not to the same extent we were, but like I mentioned, I'm reading James Joyce's Ulysses, which comes out kind of in what maybe would be a similar-ish time, not nearly the same, but a time before World War One, in Ireland and everything. And so much of that book expresses modernist angst and angst of the changing world. And so he goes internally to what does it mean to be a modern man in a world without the Odysseuses and the Achilles and all of that. And so it delves into angst that way, but it's still this kind of cultural question of the world is changing around me. What does that mean? And that's where I think, to go back to the point you were making about individualism, where that doesn't quite have the same ring to it, because if James Joyce, part of what he's asking, I don't want to claim that I have that book figured out, because I don't. It's like insane. But part of what he is asking is, what does it mean to be a modern man in this world? That's still a very relevant question, even if you're in a relatively peaceful, soft time. Whereas if you are asking the question, what does it mean for me to be in this world? That's a very shallow question. And they produce two very different types of literature.
Good.
You know, the question of me is, and I'm not an anti-individualist, but I think that, you know, we've ridden that train pretty far at that point, this point culturally, mm-hmm. into some pretty horrifying extremes.
All right. I derailed you earlier. You were about to say your second point.
Well, I think we kind of wound up getting into it. Yeah. Okay. I was going to say, you know, stuff like marketing, money.
Yeah.
So stuff we've kind of talked about along the way. But I'm curious what other people think, you know.
Yeah. I am too, because like you said, you don't have it nailed down. So, yeah, listeners, we would like to hear from you also on what your thoughts are on this.
And then also a side question to that then would be, so, okay, what would be the what would make for relevant fiction in our time? And I hate the word relevant, but you know what I mean? Like, what would be our equivalent of developing something like post-apocalyptic genre? And what would that look like in today's world? And not necessarily in the sense of developing great fiction. That's why I said I want to take quality out of it mm-hmm. earlier, because you can find some really bad post-apocalyptic or dystopian fiction. I mentioned Red Dawn, terrible movie, but it's such an important movie to that culture when mm-hmm. it comes out because of how real it feels. And so it's not necessarily an issue of quality. Nobody's going to be watching Red Dawn 500 years from now. But it's like, okay, if for people living in that world, same thing with James Bond. I mean, James Bond is important as a cultural icon, but I mean, a lot of those movies are not good, but yet they still serve this important release valve. So what does that type of stuff, whether we're talking great literature or just consumable pulp, what would that look like for our times if we got, you know, sick of our navel gazing and actually started to ask some of those deeper questions about ourselves?
Good, Ben. That was good.
All right.
Thanks for that analysis.
You're very welcome.
Yeah,
another one where I unfortunately didn't let you talk too much. I apologize.
No. I was looking forward to this conversation, and you and I had already, you know, briefly gone back and forth about it on Facebook and through email. But yeah, this was a fun one for me, and I'll be listening to the rest of that Hardcore History series.
Yeah, everyone should check it out. DanCarlin.com.
And if we get enough response from listeners about this, we should definitely maybe do a follow-up episode and just kind of put out there some of the feedback, and maybe we can elaborate more if we've come to some new conclusions.
I agree. That would be fun.
All right, Ben. Well, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono.
And we are the Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.
Yeah, goodbye.